ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Motivation, discipline, focus, performance. When you think of the way an athlete works, do those types of words spring to mind? But the psychology of performance is not just for elite athletes. It can help you do better at work too. Meet Caroline Anderson, clinical psychologist and former Olympian, and in 2004 she competed for the Australian team in Taekwondo.
Even though I was a fairly experienced athlete, I probably wasn't as prepared for the challenges. It's the type of intensity that until you've been in that space, you kind of don't really know what to expect. And I was almost a fully qualified psychologist at the time. And yet I still really lacked the skills and the resources and the understanding in that moment to help me navigate some of the pressures at that time.
Hello, I'm Lisa Leong. And for this Working Life, we're learning how to adapt skills from elite sport into the workplace. Caroline Anderson helps high-performing individuals like doctors, lawyers, and executives with their work. And she's also the lead psychologist for the Australian Olympic team. She's in Paris right now, helping our athletes with their mindset. Aussie, Aussie, Aussie!
Yeah, it's a full circle moment 20 years later. So my role there is really to support the athletes and staff on the ground during the Paris Olympics. It's really to provide an extra layer of support and really complement the amazing work that the Australian sports system already does and already has in place. I guess we're really there in case something goes wrong, for any last moment sort of top-up work with some athletes. There's a lot of athletes that I already work with that I'll be continuing to work with throughout the games and coaches, but really we're there if and when needed for whatever well-being, mental health, performance, or interpersonal issues arise, or of course any critical incidents.
I'm really interested in this idea of how what you've learnt from elite sports, from athletes, can be applied in the workplace, particularly for people who I would call corporate athletes. So these are the people who go to work every day, but kind of see themselves as brains on sticks. So they don't sort of even notice that they have a body. It's just a thing that transports their brain from place to place. If you're working with non-athlete individuals on their performance, what is transferable here?
Well, the amazing thing is, Lisa, that everything is transferable. You know, we have to remember that elite athletes are just humans. They're normal, everyday people. Likewise, so is the CEO, so is the doctor, so is the lawyer. We're all human first and foremost. There's a whole range and suite of sort of ideas and concepts that we can use. Probably the first place I would always start in working with someone would be focusing first and foremost around health and well-being, that we can't expect to perform at our peak if ultimately we're having challenges around, you know, our mental, physical well-being. And so I guess that's always where we start. We start quite holistically with your professional that's working 60, 70 hours a week. I know that I'm not here to say, right, you can't do that. That's not allowed. That's not really my place. My place is to look at if they're the kinds of hours that you're going to work, then what can we do to complement your rest recovery? And sometimes it's actually quite small things. You know, we all know exercise is important, but it might be just going for a 5-minute walk sometimes throughout your week. It might be taking breaks. It might be really prioritizing sleep, nutrition. All those really kind of basic self-care things can really get missed. And I think another really basic one is our social support system, that sometimes executives and CEOs are so busy, they kind of forget that, again, we're all human and our social connectedness is actually been shown to be what we call, it has a stress inoculation or stress buffering effect. So taking the time to connect with our social supports actually helps us move through and manage stress responses that we have through our busy working lives.
It's really interesting that very often if you are working such long hours, that health and well-being and social connections, they really get deprioritized. What do you think the block is really there?
I think people forget the priorities. I think they get so focused on what we call a kind of goal-oriented culture of sort of looking at the goal and focusing on that and just sort of putting everything we have towards that goal and really just forgetting to prioritize and also not making the connection as to how those things are actually important. The beauty is that we have so much science now to show how important these more holistic approaches are to the end goal that they're actually working towards. One of the approaches that I think is really important in the context of this is helping professionals understand really what their values and purpose are. And I think sometimes that can get a bit lost in that pursuit of goals. They're focusing on the goal rather than remembering the bigger picture around who do I want to be as a person? What legacy do I want to leave behind? What does actually create meaning in my life? And yes, working and achieving those work-related goals is part of that. But it's usually, in my experience in working with many professionals in many different backgrounds, it's usually not the full picture. And I think helping them understand their purpose, values, and why can create a little bit more motivation to understand that those other things are really important.
There's a US study that I'm interested in. It's college graduates who competed in sport show that in the first 5 years of work, they earn higher pay than their non-athlete counterparts. What's your take on that?
Oh, I love this question. I think being an athlete teaches us so many skills about the world. I mean, there's obvious ones like resilience, determination, hard work, ethic. We know all that. And I do think that those skills that we learn to harness in sport are directly transferable, you know, into, you know, pretty much all workplaces. Yeah, so that research, of course, doesn't surprise me, and I see that in the real world all the time. Having said that, you know, the transition out of sport can be really difficult for some people, and there's not always a really clear career path, and it can take a little bit of time to for athletes to learn to harness those skills that they have learned and almost sometimes taper them down into the real world because they are pretty extreme high-performing athletes, and there is a transition period to learn how to adjust to not having to do everything 100% all the time in the world post their careers.
So I wanted to be a professional tennis player when I was a little girl, but then I didn't have the skills or the height or anything that would actually turn me into a professional tennis player. So for those of us who didn't have the gift or the training and discipline to get there, how might we work like an athlete? Let's go into some of the skills that we might take from performance psychology into our working lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, there's really basic ones, and I'm actually not going to focus on these, but I'm going to say them. There's things like goal setting. There's things like debriefing post, you know, a meeting, a pitch that you've done, a presentation. There's things like mental rehearsal. Like these are direct skills that athletes use over many years, and we know that these things are helpful and beneficial and can be transferred into working life. However, the things that I'm really passionate and interested about come back to probably understanding and harnessing our stress response. So we talked earlier about that stress in our day-to-day lives. Long-term stress is obviously, we all know that it can be detrimental, it can impact on our health and well-being. But I guess that we have to learn to differentiate long-term stress from short-term stress. Short-term stress in the moment when something's difficult, when we're anxious, when we don't know the outcome, when there's anxiety, often we interpret that as being really difficult, bad, uncomfortable, something to be avoided or moved away from, just like seeing a tiger coming towards us. We call this process experiential avoidance in psychology speak. And so I think something that I'm really passionate about working with people on is helping them recognize the emotions that come up. And usually that's because our brain is a threat-seeking machine. We are constantly scanning the environment for threats to obviously keep us safe. And our body will respond to the idea or the thought of failure or the idea of criticism and judgment from our peers or colleagues in the exact same way sometimes as just like seeing a tiger would. So we get what we all know as the fight or flight response, and that can feel really uncomfortable in a workplace setting. Our heart's racing, maybe we feel a bit, you know, sick in the tummy, maybe don't feel like we can think as clearly. And what I think is really important in those kinds of moments to remember is, you know, these signals, that physiological signals that our body is sending us, aren't necessarily bad or detrimental to performance, even though they feel uncomfortable. And it's often how we interpret that experience that makes the biggest difference. So speaking about athletes for a moment, what we learn to do is help athletes recognize the feelings of anxiety and pressure or whatever that is, but not interpret them as bad, because then what we get is we don't get anxiety about anxiety. What we get is just anxiety. And we certainly have room to manage anxiety. That's okay, or a bit of that stress or doubt or fear. And we all can experience that in our day-to-day lives in workplace settings because we're human. It's natural to have those occurrences. So the first place I always start is how we interpret and view that. Once we understand that process, it means that then we can start to apply some really basic skills and techniques to help us know what we're focusing on, what we want to be doing. So once we open up to that experience of discomfort, we then do some very simple things around learning how to be present and bring our attention and shift our attention back into the present moment. That's about focus, and really sort of helping us get back on track to what we want to be doing. So they're very specific skills that we can learn about paying attention and being present. Then I guess the next skill I would get people to think about, and it's simple, right? It's not actually rocket science. It's focusing on the task. Now, that sounds so simplistic, focus on the task, and yet is actually really hard to do, and we tend not to be very good at doing it. What we tend to do is think about the past and the times we made mistakes or said something or something went wrong, or think about the future and trying to predict and do all the what ifs and all the planning, and, you know, we're trying to solve 25 problems that are in the future rather than the problem and the task at hand. So simplifying things for our brain, giving it really clear instructions, prioritizing, are some of the key things that I think can absolutely help harness performance. And I give my clients key phrases to watch out for, things like the what ifs. Yeah, so listen out for those what ifs. That's a clear indication that you're in the future and you're thinking about problems that may or may not happen. If I ask you, Lisa, do you get the what ifs? Do they come up for you?
Oh, yeah. I think I can tell when I'm ruminating on something, but I actually am pretty good at catching it nowadays.
Good. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's fantastic. I think we all naturally have the what ifs, right? This is a evolutionary throwback to trying to protect us and look after us. And I think the better we are at catching it as it's happening, you know, the more beneficial it's going to be. The other thing I often say to people is, think about all your what ifs. Have all of them ever come true? People go, oh, well, majority of the time, no. And I've spent all this time and energy trying to solve and fix and stop and problem solve all these what ifs. And a lot of them, it sort of really is a bit of a waste of time and energy sometimes. So I get them to recognize what ifs, things like the shoulds, those unrealistic expectations that we put on ourselves. How do we know that I should or shouldn't have done that? Who's guiding that? Who's making that decision? So catching our unrealistic shoulds, noticing our judgments and comparisons of other people, noticing when that little voice comes up and says, you're not good enough, you can't do this, you're going to fail. I would say we as humans all have these kinds of basic cognitions. They're all there in some ways to protect us and help survival of ourselves or of humanity, if you want. They all have a protective function. And the more we recognize that and understand that this is actually normal for us, the more that we can then create a bit of distance and space. We don't have to get so attached to these thoughts and ideas. We can recognize them as normal and also learn to let them go pretty quickly. So to come back to your question, yes, absolutely recognizing that those things and normalizing is then what helps us let go of those thoughts that pop up. And then we're kind of free to shift our attention to move to the present moment.
Let's say we've done something like a public presentation and we've stuffed it up. It's gone really badly. How do we best bounce back from something like that so that we don't end up ruminating on it over and over and just making it bigger and bigger in our minds?
Look, we all experience failure. That's something that people don't always want to recognize. the greatest athletes in the world, you know, Roger Federer, he's lost plenty and plenty of grand finals, grand slams, matches, but he's also won a lot. We have to accept that failure is a part of success. In fact, learning to embrace failure is what helps us take risks and take chances and keep pursuing greatness. We can't do that without accepting failure as part of it. But in terms of in the moment, you know, after when, you know, feeling awful about ourselves, I mean, the obvious sort of answer would be things like self-compassion. We're a human, we're going to make mistakes, we can be kind and gentle with ourselves. You know, I think sometimes people confuse self-compassion with, I don't know, being a bit lazy or letting ourselves off the hook or something. It's really not the case. Current studies show that the most high-performing individuals are those that are really self-compassionate. And this comes from the work of Kristen Neff in America, a psychologist who's done some research in this area, who does show that people who are more compassionate, self-compassionate, are able to persist longer and actually pursue harder goals. And obviously, that's highly aligned with high performance.
You hear a lot about athletes using visualization techniques to help them perform better. How might we apply this to work, say with that presentation that we're really nervous about? It's pretty high stakes. How might we use it there?
We call it probably mental rehearsal these days. It's only a slight difference. The difference is that visualization represents just using visual cues, whereas mental rehearsal encompasses the auditory, you know, experience, the tactile, the smells, sights. You know, it's much more rich, and that actually helps our brain learn from that experience. Look, it's really giving ourselves the opportunity to have exposure to something that we maybe haven't done before, or to practice. The current science says keep it quite short. You know, if you're trying to do this for 15, 20, 30, 40 minutes, our brain gets a bit fatigued, we get distracted. So keeping it quite short, very specific things that you want to be working on. But really it just, I mean, people talk about things like mirroring neurons that get activated when we do mental rehearsal, and that acts as a type of learning that then we can apply into those environments. So I just think, particularly if it's something that we haven't done before, it just gives us greater exposure to that experience and almost can feel like, oh yeah, I've done this before, I know what I'm doing, you know, and practicing the actual, you know, tasks, skills and techniques that you're going to use in the moment could be really helpful.
Let's talk about rest and recovery now, because I think, as I mentioned, this idea that when we're performing at work, we're there to use our brains and our minds, and that our bodies really are not part of it. But if you're an athlete, of course, you're thinking about, you're planning for the rest periods and the recovery and the tapering as much as you are the actual direct thing that you're trying to achieve. Say it's running. So you don't just run and run and run until you fall over. You actually stop. So can you give us some education about how we might be the best corporate athletes that we could be with rest and recovery then, Caroline?
Yeah, I would say that athletes are really good at physical recovery, but they may not always actually be good at and differentiate that with mental recovery. So I'll just say that, and I think generally us as humans are probably not that good at distinguishing. So people think flopping on the couch watching TV is recovery. That's obviously recovering our bodies if we've been running around and being really busy. It may not be actually giving us adequate mental recovery. It's a really quick fix, isn't it, that we kind of almost disassociate from the world, and it feels really good not to have to think or feel anything in that moment. The problem is it's just not really giving us a lot in return. It's not topping up that parasympathetic nervous system and helping us reach that equilibrium. So we have to sort of think, yeah, kind of what are those activities that help us do that? And there's not a one size fits all. Obviously, it's finding the thing that works for you individually. I mean, we know things like meditation and mindfulness are really beneficial, but not everybody wants to spend an hour doing mindfulness. I would say think about how to do that informally throughout your day. Take a mindful moment, you know, have a cup of tea, sit down with your coffee. Don't grab your phone if you're in the queue waiting for your coffee. Just sit there and observe things around you. Yeah, take a moment. What you'll notice is everyone else has got their phone out while they're waiting in line for the coffee, but just spend a moment. And I think that it's actually small things that do make the biggest difference in this space. I know it's not realistic for everyone to do an hour of yoga, an hour of meditation, an hour of this, an hour. Like, we just, not everyone has the time, but it is probably those smaller things.
Some of you This Working Lifers nominated tips on how you behave like a corporate athlete. This one from Liam: giving 100% shouldn't mean 100% all of the time, just on game day. Sally says, like athletes, we can use food to give your body what it needs, when it needs it, so you are performing at your best. And Kate believes in the power of micro breaks to keep her focused. Go team! Speaking of, what can we learn from performance psychology about teamwork?
There's been some recent studies done by my friend and colleague, Dr. Lauren Burns. She won a gold medal at the Sydney 2000 Olympics in my sport, taekwondo. And she's gone on to do a PhD looking at these sort of performance lifestyle factors that set people up for success at performing at their highest level. And one of the factors that she found was supportive teams and the support network around the athlete was one of the most influential factors. So good teamwork and being able to work well together, support each other, is highly correlated with good outcomes. We obviously also know the work of Amy, I'm sure many of your listeners have heard of the work of Amy Edmondson around psychological safety and psychological safety in teams, and Project Aristotle, which Google, you know, many number of years ago sort of investigated what their high performance teams, what made them tick and what really was the most important factor to help them perform well. And psychological safety was one of those things. It is what it sounds like, that it's safe to be who you are, to speak up, to ask questions, to get it wrong, and to make mistakes. I think that's probably one of the biggest factors in teams, is to know that if I make a mistake, I'm not going to be ridiculed or criticized. We're going to explore this and look at it together as a team and figure out a way forward.
So just finally, what else can we learn from athletes when it comes to performing in a better and more psychologically sustainable way at work?
I think probably the biggest thing I'd come back to is values and a sense of perspective. Hard work, determination, and perfectionism seem like they're aligned with best performance, but what they often do is if we're doing too much of that, we're overworking, overtraining, doing more in order to get better, that solution doesn't always exist. What often happens is we get burnout, and obviously that's not good for, you know, sustainable long-term careers, whether it's in sport or in business. So it's learning how to harness our dedication, but think about it a bit more holistically in terms of health and well-being, but also come back to the bigger picture and perspective that you're not going to get it perfect all the time. You will make mistakes and you will fail, and keep persevering anyway. And we keep persevering because ultimately it's about our values and purpose. And I would definitely get people to really dig down deep on this. It's something that can be kind of done a bit superficially. Oh yeah, this is my purpose. This is actually really important work to explore our values. Who do I want to be at work? What's important to me? And that's a lifelong thing that we keep working on. It's not goals. We don't tick off and go, oh, yes, I've got this promotion or whatever. It's really bigger than that, and it's what creates meaning and sustainable, not just performance, but I guess satisfaction in life.
Thanks so much for speaking with us, Caroline, and all the best.
Thank you so much for having me, Lisa.
Caroline Anderson, clinical and performance psychologist, former Olympian, and the lead psychologist for the Australian Olympic team for Paris 2024. Next time. In the 90s, we all attended these workshops about executive presence. And from memory, it involved something called gravitas, where I was told to frown more, and power dressing. Look out those shoulder pads. Is it still relevant? And what is presence now? You've been listening to This Working Life with me, Lisa Leong. It was produced by Michelle Weeks and mixed by Carey Dell on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naarm, Melbourne. Until next time, work it, baby. Oh, and stay with me one more sec, will you? 8 hours is a long time to spend sitting at a desk. But offices are adapting, standing desks, we've got adjustable monitors. But it does make you wonder what the risks are for our backs, for our shoulders and our necks. Our friends over at What's That Rash answer the health questions everyone's asking, including this recent one. Are our office jobs ruining our bodies? Dr. Norman Swan hosts the show alongside Tegan Taylor. Norman, hello.
Hi, Lisa.
What's the verdict?
Well, the verdict is yes and no, as always. We overestimate the impact of offices and ergonomics on our bodies. I mean, sure, you can be in, and home offices are another issue altogether here because that terrifies employers because you're taking a dining room chair to a fixed table and who knows what position you're in. Let's just start with your metabolic fitness. There's no people say sitting is the new smoking. Well, it's not true. It's simply not true. Smoking is so toxic and it exceeds sitting by a long, long way. And what they've shown is that if you've got an office job, as indeed most people have, getting exercise to the required amount, 150 minutes a week, negates the negative effect of sitting all day in an office situation. Standing desks probably don't counteract the sitting effect because you're standing still. Most people are standing still at their standing desk. So a lot of this is actually about comfort. And there's a lot of misunderstanding about posture, for example. So let's just take backs, for example. You see signs up about how to lift and your back's got to be straight and don't stoop and so on. The reality is that stooping and a slightly curved position to our spine is what most of us find most comfortable. And there's not a lot of evidence that that classic posture protects your back. There's also not a lot of evidence that just working at a desk is going to harm your arms and your neck and your back. Sure, you can be in a position where it's harmful, where you feel a bit of neck strain because your screen is not at eye level. And you know, certainly in my home office, I've got a little cheap thing that holds my laptop up so that finds comfortable. See, a lot of this is actually common sense, and you want things that are adjustable for your comfort. But the science is pretty weak around ergonomics. In the 80s, there was an epidemic of repetitive strain injury in Australia and in some parts of the United States. The Los Angeles Times was crippled by it, where people got arm and neck pain, they believed, as a result of poor ergonomics at work. It turned out that the relationship between arm and neck pain and the office situation had nothing to do with ergonomics and everything to do with the structure of the office, which is, and management, which is what you talk about a lot on your show, which is that where you had rapid introduction of new technology without consulting workers, where they felt they were being put upon and out of control of the situation, that was the situation where a repetitive strain injury became most common, and notoriously in some particular workplaces, like I said, the Los Angeles Times and some government offices in Australia. And when they brought in the ergonomists to bring in adjustable desks, adjustable height to your screen and so on, the epidemic went away, but not necessarily because of the ergonomics, but because people felt more in control of their work situation, which is fair enough that you were allowed to adjust your desk to your own level of comfort.
Always intriguing. Thanks so much, Norman. And where can we find this episode?
It's wherever you get your podcasts. What's That Rash, the latest episode.
Thanks, Norman. Speak to you next time. Back to your nap.
Bye.
It's easier than ever to hear your favourite local and national ABC radio stations live and on demand on the ABC Listen app.